This chemistry cassette is the second tape in the A-level series produced by the Educational Techniques Group Trust of the Royal Society of Chemistry. It's entitled Competition Processes and has been produced and is presented by Graham Hill, who is Deputy Headmaster at Dr. Challoner's Grammar School in Amersham, and John Holman, who's Head of Science at Watford Grammar School. The cassette is accompanied by a workbook, which is an essential part of the study package. It contains diagrams, equations, formulae, and other material which the speakers will frequently refer to. So have the workbook with you as you listen, and also have pen and paper so that you can make notes. If you look into the workbook, you'll see that it's divided into numbered sections that we call frames. The speakers will give you the appropriate frame number when they want you to look at any of the material there. You may also have noticed that some of the frames contain problems. Be ready to attempt these as you work through the tape. The answer's at the end of the book, but don't look at them until you've attempted the problems. A great advantage of an audio tape is that you can work through it at your own rate. Switch off if you want to spend a little time digesting what you have heard, or if you want to make some notes or do a problem. And use the rewind control if you want to go over again something that you've not fully understood on a first hearing. Now here are Graham Hill and John Holman. Graham speaks first.
This programme is like the others in our series of talks, in that it draws together important ideas from several areas of chemistry. In this programme, the underlying theme is competition. Look at frame one. In any competition, and it doesn't matter whether it's a game of tennis, a game of Scrabble, a game of football, or a game of Monopoly, different players compete for something. The players might be competing for points, for goals, or for money. Many chemical reactions are also like this. They involve reactions in which two different substances compete with each other for a third reactant. Just consider what happens when aluminium doors and window frames are exposed to water vapour in the atmosphere. At first, the aluminium is shiny, but it gradually tarnishes and becomes covered with a layer of aluminium oxide. The aluminium has reacted with water to form aluminium oxide and hydrogen. The equation for this reaction is shown in frame 2. Here, there is a simple competition between hydrogen and aluminium for oxygen. Aluminium is the stronger competitor, so it wins the fight for oxygen and takes it away from hydrogen to form aluminium oxide. Of course, when aluminium articles are exposed to the air, they react with oxygen in the air as well as water vapour. The equation for this reaction is shown on frame 3. In this case, the competitors are aluminium atoms and oxygen atoms. The oxygen atoms can either remain combined with each other as oxygen molecules, O2, or they can combine with aluminium atoms and form aluminium oxide. Since the aluminium readily reacts to form aluminium oxide, it is clear that aluminium is a stronger competitor for oxygen atoms than oxygen atoms are for each other.
There are millions and millions of reactions that chemical substances can undergo. Many of these reactions can be divided into four major classes, which are listed on frame 4. These are redox reactions, acid-base reactions, precipitation reactions, and complexing reactions. All of these reactions involve competitions of some sort. Let's look at each of these in turn, in order to see what the competing substances are like and what they are competing for. We'll start with redox reactions. When metals react with oxygen, they form oxides. Two examples are shown on frame 5. In each of these reactions, the metal is oxidized and the oxygen is reduced. During this process, the metal atoms lose electrons to form positive ions, and oxygen gains electrons to form negative ions, O2-. The reaction of magnesium with oxygen is shown in more detail on frame 5, and this shows how oxygen takes the electrons, which are given away by the metal. Electron transfer reactions such as this are called reduction-oxidation reactions, or redox reactions for short. The separate equations showing which substance gains electrons and which substance loses electrons are known as half equations. In the first half equation on frame 5, magnesium loses electrons and is oxidized to Mg2+. At the same time, oxygen, O2, gains electrons and is reduced to oxide ions, O2-. Originally, the term oxidation was restricted to the gain of oxygen, and reduction was restricted to the loss of oxygen. Nowadays, the meanings of these terms have been extended. Oxidation is now defined as loss of electrons, and reduction is defined as gain of electrons. Oxidizing agents, such as oxygen, are therefore defined as substances which accept electrons, and reducing agents are substances which donate or give up electrons. These definitions are given at the bottom of frame 5. When redox is viewed in terms of electron transfer, it's easy to see why oxidation and reduction must always take place together. One substance cannot lose electrons and be oxidized unless another substance gains electrons and is reduced.
In your studies of chemistry, you will have met several types of redox reaction. Some of these are shown in frame 6, with an example of each reaction type. Notice in frame 6 that redox reactions include the reactions of metals with nonmetals, with water, with steam, and with acids. They also include reactions at the electrodes during electrolysis and disproportionation reactions. Disproportionation reactions are those in which some particles of a substance are oxidized and other particles of the same substance are simultaneously reduced. In the fifth example on frame 6, two Cu+ ions react with each other. One of these Cu+ ions is reduced to copper, Cu, whilst the other Cu+ ion is oxidized to Cu2+. The best check for redox is to consider the oxidation numbers or oxidation state of the elements involved in the reaction. Oxidation numbers provide a quantitative measure of the relative extent of oxidation or reduction of an atom in different substances. In redox reactions, there must be at least one element that changes its oxidation number during the reaction. If the oxidation number becomes more positive, the element has been oxidized. If it becomes more negative, the element has been reduced. Look at the equations of the six reactions on frame 7 and try to decide which of them represent redox processes. Most redox reactions involve a transfer of electrons from one reactant to another. For example, when metals react with nonmetals, electrons are transferred from the metal to the nonmetal and ions are formed. The reaction of sodium with chlorine is shown in frame 8. Sodium loses electrons and is oxidized, whilst chlorine gains electrons and is reduced. In this case, the reaction occurs because nonmetals like chlorine are eager to gain electrons, whilst metals like sodium will part with their electrons quite readily. In the competition for electrons, chlorine wins hands down. At the start of this program, we looked at the reaction of aluminium with water as a competition process. The equation for this reaction is shown again on frame 9. Try to answer the questions below the equation.
A competition for electrons in redox reactions is not always as clear-cut as in the reactions of metals with nonmetals and the reactions of metals with water that we've just been discussing. However, we can use electrode potentials to check whether, and in which direction, a redox reaction is occurring. Frame 10 shows the electron transfer which occurs when a half cell, made from a zinc rod in zinc sulfate solution, is connected by a salt bridge to a half cell made from a copper rod in copper sulfate solution. The salt bridge completes the circuit by allowing ions carrying charge to move from one half cell to the other. If the salt bridge is removed, the current ceases because charge, whether it's electrons or ions, can no longer flow around the circuit. When the two metals are joined through a bulb, the bulb lights, showing that electrons are flowing through the wire. Zinc dissolves from the zinc rod, causing it to lose weight. At the same time, copper is deposited on the copper rod, which gains weight. The reactions at the terminals can be represented by the half equations at the bottom of frame 10. Electrons flow from the negative zinc terminal through the external circuit to the positive copper terminal. Here, the electrons combine with copper ions and copper is deposited. Obviously, copper ions have a stronger attraction for electrons than zinc ions, and they win the competition for electrons. If the bulb is replaced by a voltmeter, it is possible to measure the potential difference between the two half cells. By using a high-resistance voltmeter, the current flowing in the external circuit is virtually zero, and the cell registers its maximum potential difference, which is usually called the electromotive force, or EMF for short. This EMF gives a quantitative measure of the likelihood of the redox reaction taking place in the cell. When we do this for the cell in frame 10, a voltage of 1.1 volts is recorded. We can say that the cell EMF, E cell, is 1.1 volts. Frame 11 summarizes this combination of half cells and the resulting cell EMF. This summary is called a cell diagram. When we write a cell diagram, we always use a special convention which shows the direction of the reaction. We write the half cell involving oxidation on the left and the half cell involving reduction on the right. In frame 11, this means that zinc, Zn, becomes zinc ions, Zn2+, and copper ions, Cu2+, become copper metal, Cu. This is, of course, the reaction shown at the bottom of frame 10. Following this convention, we also assign a positive value to the EMF, usually labelled E, provided the reaction actually goes in the direction indicated in the summary. If the reactions take place in the opposite direction to those shown in the summary, then the convention is to give E a negative sign.
When the zinc half cell in frame 10 is replaced by other half cells, the results shown in frame 12 are obtained. Notice that the first three metals, zinc, iron, and lead, all have negative polarity with respect to copper. This means that these three metals give up electrons more easily than copper, so they are stronger reducing agents than copper, and go into solution as their ions when the cells are short-circuited. But look at the silver half cell. The cell EMF shows that silver is positive with respect to copper, and in this case copper is acting as the reducing agent. A cell diagram with a silver half cell is summarized at the bottom of frame 12. Strictly speaking, the cell diagram should be written with the copper half cell on the left of the salt bridge, and the silver half cell on the right. This would then give a value of plus 0.46 volts for the EMF. When this cell delivers a current, copper forms copper ions, and silver ions are converted to silver metal. In this case, Ag plus ions win the competition for electrons. Frame 13 shows how the relative potentials of the copper, zinc, and silver half cells can be represented diagrammatically. Use this diagram to answer the questions on frame 13.
The size of cell EMFs, as shown in frame 12, can be used to place metals in order of their relative ability as reducing agents. Zinc, at the top of the table in frame 12, is a strong reducing agent, releasing electrons quite readily. But silver at the bottom is a very poor reducing agent. Conversely, we can also draw up a list of metal ions showing their ability as oxidizing agents. Thus, the silver ion Ag+ is a stronger oxidizing agent than Zn2+, and Ag+ ions will win the competition for electrons with Zn2+ ions. You've probably realized already why it is impossible to obtain the electrode potential for a single half cell. EMFs can only be measured for a complete circuit with two electrodes, so only differences in potential are measurable. Nevertheless, it would be very useful if we could summarize all EMF data by giving each separate half cell its own value, because then we would have a quantitative measure of the reducing strength of each metal. We can do this by assigning an electrode potential of zero to one particular half cell, and then comparing all other half cells with this standard. The standard that chemists have chosen for electrode potentials is not a metal, but hydrogen. The so-called standard hydrogen half cell, which is sometimes called the standard hydrogen electrode, is shown in frame 14. This consists of hydrogen gas at 25 degrees Celsius and 1 atmosphere pressure, bubbling around a platinized platinum electrode, which is immersed in a solution containing 1 mole per cubic decimeter of H+ ions. In this way, the platinum electrode is in contact with both aqueous H+ ions and hydrogen gas. Hydrogen is adsorbed onto the platinum, and an equilibrium is set up between the adsorbed layer of H2 and H+ ions in the solution. The equation for this equilibrium is shown on the bottom of frame 14. The platinized platinum electrode plays an important part in the hydrogen half cell. First, it acts as an inert metal, an electrode for any transfer of electrons to or from the H2 gas and H+ ions. Second, it allows H2 gas to be adsorbed onto its surface, and therefore ready to give up electrons. Third, being platinized, it is covered by a loosely deposited layer of platinum, which increases its surface area and helps to set up an equilibrium between hydrogen gas and aqueous H+ ions as rapidly as possible. The standard electrode potential for this reference half cell is defined as zero. Notice the special superscript, a circle with a line through it for the E standard symbol. This convention is used to show that the electrode potential is standard.
Look closely at frame 14. Whenever we use a standard hydrogen half cell, its electrode potential is always taken to be zero. But the ease with which the standard hydrogen electrode gives or takes electrons will be affected by three important factors: concentration of H+ ions, the pressure of the hydrogen gas, and the temperature. Because of this, we must choose the same standard conditions for all measurements of electrode potentials. These standard conditions are listed in frame 15. All aqueous ions are at a concentration of 1 mole per cubic decimeter. Any gases involved are at a pressure of 1 atmosphere. The temperature must be 25 degrees Celsius. And finally, platinum is used as the electrode when the half cell system does not include another metal. Frame 16 shows a standard Cu2+, Cu half cell, and a standard Fe3+, Fe2+, half cell. Notice that the second of these does not involve a metal, only metal ions. So a platinum electrode is used as the electrical connection. Notice also that the solution contains both Fe3+ and Fe2+ ions at a concentration of 1 mole per cubic decimeter. The standard potentials of all half cells are obtained by comparison with the standard hydrogen half cell. So the standard electrode potential of the Cu2+, Cu half cell is the potential difference between the electrodes of a cell consisting of the standard hydrogen half cell and the standard Cu2+, Cu half cell. This is shown in frame 17. When this cell is set up, the voltmeter reads 0.34 volts, and copper is the positive terminal. This means that there is a tendency for electrons to be given up by the hydrogen half cell. These electrons flow through the external circuit to the copper half cell. So H2 gas is tending to give up electrons and form H+ ions, whilst Cu2+ ions are taking these electrons to form copper metal. These reactions are shown at the bottom of frame 17. Now, since the standard electrode potential for the H+H2 system is taken as zero, the standard electrode potential for the reaction Cu2+ plus 2E- to Cu is plus 0.34 volts. The plus sign is used because the copper electrode is positively charged with respect to the standard hydrogen electrode. When a standard zinc half cell is connected to a standard hydrogen half cell, the EMF produced is 0.76 volts. But in this case, the zinc electrode is negative and the current flows in the opposite direction. This means that electrons are given up by zinc and then taken by H+ ions to form hydrogen gas. The reactions occurring at the electrodes are shown in frame 18. the standard electropotential for the Zn2 plus Zn half cell is therefore minus 0.76 volts, and this is also shown on frame 18. Before pressing on, see if you can answer the questions on frame 19.
Standard electropotentials provide a useful measure of the relative oxidizing and reducing power of different atoms and ions. They tell us how well reducing agents give up electrons and how well oxidizing agents compete for electrons. The standard electropotentials give a measure of the competition for electrons between various ions and H+. They can be compared to the score in sports competitions. The standard electropotentials of the zinc, hydrogen and copper half-cells are given in frame 20 so as to emphasize the relative strengths of the different oxidizing and reducing agents. Under standard conditions, Cu2+ is a stronger oxidizing agent than either H+ or Zn2+. So, under these conditions, Cu2+ ions win the competition for electrons with H+ or Zn2+, and they can oxidize H2 to H+ and Zn to Zn2+. On the other hand, Zn is a more powerful reducing agent than either H2 or Cu. The standard electropotentials for a large number of redox half-reactions are shown in frame 21. Remember that a reaction is more favourable if its E standard is more positive. The table is arranged so that the strongest oxidizing agent, F2, which has the most positive value for E standard, is at the top of the list, and the weakest oxidizing agent, K+, with the most negative value for E standard, is at the bottom. Thus, fluorine is a better competitor for electrons than any other oxidizing agent in the list, whilst potassium ions have the weakest tendency to accept electrons. Conversely, F- is the weakest reducing agent, with the least tendency to donate electrons, whilst potassium, K, is the most powerful reducing agent in the list. Try to answer the questions about oxidizing and reducing agents on frame 21 before moving on.
So far, we've looked at redox reactions and studied the way in which oxidizing agents compete for electrons. Now let's look at another kind of competition, this time in acid-base reactions. During the 19th century, the Swedish chemist Arrhenius put forward the idea that acids were substances which split up or dissociated in water to produce hydrogen ions, H+. So in hydrochloric acid, hydrogen chloride would split up into H+ ions and Cl- ions. The equation for this is shown on frame 22. We now know that strong acids like hydrochloric acid and nitric acid are completely dissociated in dilute aqueous solution, but weak acids like ethanoic acid and carbonic acid are only partly dissociated, with some of the acid remaining in the undissociated form. Thus, a solution of ethanoic acid can be represented by an equilibrium like the one in frame 22. With the development of knowledge concerning atomic structure, chemists realized that H+ ions were simply protons. In aqueous solution, these H+ ions associate with polar water molecules to form H3O+ ions. This means that the dissociation of acids in water can be represented more correctly as shown on frame 23. Notice that both the processes shown on frame 23 involve water molecules. In each case, the acid molecule and a water molecule compete for a proton, H+. In the case of HCl, water is the clear winner, and all the HCl molecules are converted into chloride ions, Cl-. Water molecules which pick up these protons are converted into what we call oxonium ions, H3O+. In the case of ethanoic acid, the acid molecules hold their protons more firmly than HCl. In this case, we have an equilibrium with CH3COOH, H2O, H3O+, and CH3COO-, all present. We use the split arrows, as shown in frame 23, to indicate this equilibrium. Competition processes involving protons are perhaps the most important competition processes in chemistry. Because they are so common, chemists sometimes abbreviate the relevant equations in the way we did in frame 22. This is easier to write, but it detracts from the fact that water plays a vital part in the process. Don't forget that in all these cases, there is an actual chemical reaction between the acid molecules and water molecules. This explains why concentrated sulfuric acid is so dangerous. It reacts with water, giving out a lot of heat. And remember that the acid solutions never contain naked protons. These are all firmly attached to water molecules or acid molecules. In fact, protons are so reactive that they never exist on their own in liquids or solids. Naked protons can only be found under extreme conditions. For example, on the sun or in electrical discharge tubes. So although we may write H plus aqueous, we really mean H3O plus aqueous. Arrhenius' theory also included the concept of bases. He suggested that bases like copper oxide and copper hydroxide were substances which reacted with H plus ions to form water. The equations for the reactions of copper oxide and copper hydroxide with H plus ions are shown in frame 24. You will have realized by now that acid-base reactions involve competitions for H plus ions or protons. In order to widen the scope of acid-base reactions, Bronsted and Lowry defined acids as proton donors and bases as proton acceptors. The Bronsted-Lowry theory is an improvement on Arrhenius' theory because it recognizes ammonium ions and acid salts like sodium hydrogen sulfate as acids, since they can donate protons just like the more conventional acids. What is more, bases can now include anions, water and ammonia, as well as oxide and hydroxide ions. The reactions of these substances are summarized by the equations in frame 25. Notice on frame 25 that some substances, such as water, can act as both acids and bases, according to the Bronsted-Lowry definitions. Before we continue, see if you can answer the questions on frame 26.
When dilute hydrochloric acid is added to sodium sulfide, hydrogen sulfide is produced. The equation for the reaction is shown in frame 27. This reaction shows that hydrochloric acid is a stronger acid than hydrogen sulfide because it donates H plus ions, or protons, to sulfide ions, forming hydrogen sulfide, H2S. Another way of looking at this reaction is to say that sulfide is a stronger base than chloride, because when these two anions compete for H plus ions, the sulfide wins easily. So, acid-base reactions involve competitions between bases for protons, in the same way that redox reactions involve competitions between oxidizing agents for electrons. Using the idea of acids as proton donors and bases as proton acceptors, we can arrange all acids and bases in a league table showing their relative strengths. From the reaction of hydrochloric acid with sodium sulfide, we know that hydrochloric acid is a stronger acid than hydrogen sulfide, and that sulfide is a stronger base than chloride. When dilute hydrochloric acid is added to a solution of sodium benzoate, a white precipitate of benzoic acid appears. This shows that hydrochloric acid is a stronger acid than benzoic acid, because it has pushed protons onto benzoate ions, forming benzoic acid, which is insoluble in water. The equation for this reaction is shown on frame 28. But what happens when hydrogen sulfide is added to a solution of sodium benzoate? In this case, no reaction occurs, and there is no precipitate of benzoic acid. This shows that hydrogen sulfide is a weaker acid than benzoic acid. The results of these simple tests are tabulated in frame 29. Hydrochloric acid, which is the strongest acid, is at the top of the table on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, the bases get stronger towards the bottom. Earlier in this program, we found that electrode potentials could be used to give a quantitative measure of the relative strengths of oxidizing agents in competing for electrons. In the case of acids and bases, we can compare their strengths by measuring their pH. Problem 7 on frame 30 looks at two experiments to compare acid strengths.
Although the pH of a solution gives some idea of the strength of an acid or a base, the use of pHs in this respect is very limited, because pH will change as the concentration of the acid or the base changes. So chemists looked for a more useful way of measuring the strengths of acids and bases. They found this by considering the equilibria which are set up when acids and bases dissociate in aqueous solution. Look at frame 31. This shows an equation for the dissociation of an acid, which we can call HX. Notice that we have written the dissociation equation in its complete form, including water. From this equation, we can write an expression for the equilibrium constant of the reaction, and this constant is, of course, Kc. We can, however, simplify this expression, because the concentration of water in the acid solution is virtually constant. This means that we can multiply Kc by the concentration of water to give a new constant, which we call the acid dissociation constant, symbol Ka. This is just what we've done in frame 31. In the final expression for Ka, we can simplify H3O plus aqueous to H plus aqueous, as we did before. This expression for Ka now relates to a simpler equation for the dissociation of HX, as shown at the bottom of frame 31. The value of a dissociation constant can be calculated using the expression on frame 31, if we know the concentration of the acid and its pH. Let's do this for ethanoic acid. Experiments show that a solution of ethanoic acid containing 0.01 moles per cubic decimeter has a pH of 3.4. Frame 32 shows the dissociation equation for ethanoic acid and the expression for its dissociation constant. If we can calculate the concentration of H plus ions, the concentration of ethanoate ions, and the concentration of undissociated ethanoic acid, then we can obtain Ka. The concentration of H plus ions can be obtained from the pH reading. pH is equal to minus log to base 10 of the hydrogen ion concentration. So we can calculate the H plus ion concentration as shown on frame 32. The rest of the calculation is fairly straightforward, so you should be able to follow it easily. Make sure that you can follow the calculation and check that you have understood the working by answering the problem at the bottom of frame 32. As we have seen, dissociation constants are really equilibrium constants, so they should be unaffected by changes in concentrations. This means that the value of Ka gives a measure of how much an acid is dissociated, and this in turn tells us the strength of the acid. The larger the value of Ka, the greater is the tendency for the acid to dissociate, and the stronger is the acid. The values of Ka for a few acids are given in frame 33. As we said earlier, acid-base reactions are competitions for H plus ions or protons. The winners of these competitions are strong bases, which have the strongest attraction for H plus ions. The losers are strong acids, substances with the weakest attraction for H plus ions.
We must now turn to the third type of competition, precipitation reactions. If you've ever washed in hard water, you'll know that a scum forms whenever soap is used. Scum is an insoluble solid, which forms when calcium ions in the hard water react with anions in the soap, such as stearate, palmitate, and oleate. An equation for the reaction is shown on frame 34. The complicated anions in the soap are represented by X minus. Scum is an example of a precipitate, an insoluble solid which forms when aqueous solutions are mixed. Other important examples of precipitation take place in the formation of stalagmites and stalactites, and in the formation of shells and corals by sea creatures. All of these processes involve the precipitation of calcium carbonate from solutions containing calcium ions and carbonate ions. The equation for these reactions is shown on frame 35, and on frame 36 you can see a tropical seashell. So, if precipitation is a competition process, what kind of competition is involved? When an ionic substance dissolves in water, the separate ions are surrounded by water molecules, and we say the ions are hydrated. Frame 37 shows the structure of hydrated positive and negative ions. Notice how oxygen atoms in the water molecules get closest to the positive ion, but hydrogen atoms get closest to the negative ion. This is because the water molecules are polar, with a small overall negative charge nearer the oxygen and a small overall positive charge towards the hydrogens. Frame 38 shows what happens when these hydrated ions come together and form a precipitate of the insoluble ionic solid. For convenience, we've drawn the water molecules as triangles, with delta plus and delta minus charges, to show their polarity. When the insoluble solid is precipitated, the hydrated ions lose their water molecules and form a regular arrangement of positive and negative ions in the solid crystal. The attraction of the ions for each other is greater than their separate attractions for water molecules. In this competition, the positive ions have competed with the water molecules for the negative ions, and the positive ions have won. In the same way, negative ions have triumphed over water molecules in the competition for positive ions.
Although some ionic substances, like calcium carbonate, are insoluble and readily form a precipitate, other ionic substances, like sodium chloride, are very soluble in water. So the positive and negative ions do not always compete more effectively for each other than they do for water. In the case of sodium chloride, sodium ions seem to have a stronger attraction for water molecules than they have for chloride ions. In the competition for sodium ions, water molecules beat chloride ions. In order to get some idea of the competition in precipitation reactions, let's look at the equilibrium between an insoluble solid and its ions in aqueous solution. Frame 39 shows an equation for the equilibrium between solid calcium carbonate and its aqueous ions. From this equation, we can write an equilibrium constant, as in frame 40. In this equilibrium, the concentration of calcium carbonate is constant, because the concentration of a solid is proportional to its density, and this is virtually constant. So we can incorporate the concentration of calcium carbonate with Kc, and obtain a new constant as shown on frame 40. This new constant involves only the aqueous ions. It's called the solubility product, and is given the symbol Ksp. The last equation on frame 40 shows the solubility product expression for calcium carbonate. From this expression, we can deduce that the concentration of carbonate ions in aqueous solution at 25 degrees Celsius can never exceed 5 times 10 to the minus 9. So, if we mix a solution containing 10 to the minus 3 moles per cubic decimeter of calcium ions with a solution containing 10 to the minus 3 mole per cubic decimeter of carbonate ions, a precipitate of calcium carbonate will form, because the concentration of calcium ions multiplied by the concentration of carbonate ions will be greater than 5 times 10 to the minus 9. Calcium carbonate will precipitate until the product of the concentration of the aqueous ions reaches 5 times 10 to the minus 9. At this point, solid calcium carbonate will be in equilibrium with its ions.
The solubility product expression for calcium carbonate is fairly simple, because CaCO3 only forms one Ca2 plus ion and one CO3 2 minus ion when it dissolves in water. Frame 41 shows how we can deduce a general expression for solubility products using the formula AxBy for the insoluble solid. Notice how the concentrations of the ions are raised to powers x and y in the expression for Ksp. You will see on frame 41 that these powers come from the numbers of ions in the formula of the insoluble salt. There is one other problem that we should mention about solubility products. As long as the concentrations of ions are less than about 10 to the minus 2 moles per cubic decimeter, the value of Ksp remains constant at a given temperature. But when ionic concentrations rise above 10 to the minus 2 moles per cubic decimeter, the ions are so close together that their attractions and repulsions start to affect their behaviour, and the solubility product is no longer constant. This means that we cannot use the solubility product idea with soluble compounds like sodium chloride and copper sulfate. For these substances, their ordinary solubility in grams of solute per 100 grams of water can provide a measure of the competition between the ions and water. If the solubility of a substance and its solubility product are small, its concentration of hydrated ions will be low, and this suggests that the attraction of the ions are greater for each other than for water molecules. Frame 42 shows the solubilities and the solubility products for a few substances at 25 degrees Celsius. Of all the substances on frame 42, lead sulfide is the least soluble. This means that lead ions and sulfide ions always compete much better for each other than they do for water. Lead sulfide is so insoluble that it would require a reservoir 1 kilometre long, 1 kilometre wide and 1 kilometre deep to dissolve just 1 gram of it. Before moving on to the last part of this programme, this will be a convenient point to check that you have understood this section on precipitation by switching off the tape and trying to answer the questions on frame 43.
The last part of this programme is about complex ions and the competition processes which occur when complex ions are formed. During the last section, we looked at the hydration of cations and anions by water molecules. Frame 44 shows the structures of 3 hydrated cations. Notice that the hydrated magnesium ion is shown with 6 water molecules, the hydrated copper ion is shown with 4 water molecules, and the hydrated silver ion has only 2 water molecules. In these ions, the water molecules are bound to the central cation by coordinate bonds. Other polar molecules and anions can coordinate to metal ions in the same way as water. Frame 45 shows the structures and formulae of 3 ions formed in this way. In ammonia solution, the Cu2+ ion exists mainly as tetraamine copper 2 ions, CuNH3+4, 2+, whilst Ag+ exists as diamine silver 1 ions, AgNH3+2+. These are shown on the left and in the centre of frame 45. When iron 3 ions are mixed with cyanide ions, the Fe3+ ions react to give hexacyanoferrate 3 ions, FeCn6-3-. The structure of this is shown on the right of frame 45. Ions like these, which contain a metal ion joined to a number of anions or molecules, are called complex ions. And the anions and molecules like H2O, NH3 and CN-, firmly bonded to the central cation, are called ligands. All ligands contain at least one atom with a lone pair of electrons, which can be donated to the central cation, forming a coordinate bond. Water is by far the most common ligand. The strengths of the coordinate bonds between different cations and water molecules can be compared using their hydration energies. A general equation for the hydration energy process is shown at the top of frame 46. Below it, we have tabulated the ionic radii and hydration energies of a few cations. The more negative the hydration energy, the stronger the bonds between the ion and water. Use the information in the table to answer the questions at the bottom of frame 46.
So far, we've seen that redox reactions involve competitions for electrons, acid-base reactions involve competitions for protons, and precipitation reactions involve competitions of anions and cations for each other or for water molecules. In a similar way, complexing reactions involve competitions between different ligands for metal cations. For example, when excess ammonia solution is added to aqueous copper 2 sulfate, ammonia molecules displace water molecules from hydrated copper 2 ions, forming tetraamine copper 2 ions, and the colour changes from pale blue to dark blue. The equation for this reaction is shown on frame 47. In this case, ammonia acts as a stronger ligand than water. In the competition for copper 2 ions, ammonia beats water. Notice the similarity between acid-base reactions and complexing reactions. Many substances, like water, ammonia, and cyanide, which act as bases, also act as ligands. In acid-base reactions, these substances compete for H+ ions. But in complexing reactions, they compete for positively charged metal ions. In general, more powerful ligands will displace less powerful ligands from a complex ion. So, as you will see from frame 48, when aqueous 1,2-diaminoethane is added to a dark blue solution containing tetraamine copper 2 ions, the colour changes to violet as 1,2-diaminoethane molecules displace ammonia molecules from the copper 2 ions. The structure of the 1,2-diaminoethane copper complex is also shown on frame 48. Notice how this new complex ion is planar, like the tetraamine copper 2 ion. There are, however, even stronger ligands than 1,2-diaminoethane. One of these is EDTA, which is short for ethylene diamine tetraacetate. The structure of this ligand is shown on frame 49. When an aqueous solution of EDTA is added to a violet solution containing the diaminoethane copper 2 complex, the colour changes to pale blue, as EDTA replaces diaminoethane molecules on the copper 2 ions. The structure of the copper EDTA complex ion is shown in frame 50. Notice how the EDTA can encapsulate a metal ion. This helps to explain why it is such a powerful ligand. These experiments show the relative strengths of different ligands with copper 2 ions. From the reactions we've described, the strongest ligand is EDTA, then 1,2-diaminoethane, then ammonia, and finally water. In any competition of these ligands for Cu2+ ions, EDTA would always win and displace the others.
In all the chemical competitions that we have studied, chemists have found a way of measuring the score by looking at the competitiveness of different reactants. In order to get a measure of the competitiveness of different ligands for cations, chemists have studied the equilibrium between aqueous cations and complexed cations. Frame 51 shows the general equation for the complexing reaction involved and the equation for the equilibrium constant. These equilibrium constants give a measure of the extent to which the ligand L displaces water molecules by forming stronger bonds to the central cation, so they give a measure of the stability of the complex in solution. Because of this, they are usually called stability constants and given the special symbol KST, as shown in frame 51. Look at the equations and the stability constants for the three copper complexes on frame 52. The larger the magnitude of the stability constant, the greater is the extent of the forward reaction. Therefore, the proportion of complexed copper 2+ to uncomplexed copper 2+ will be highest when the ligand is EDTA, and lowest when it is ammonia. You should now be able to answer the questions on frame 53.
In this program, we have looked at four important types of reaction. We have found that redox reactions involve competitions between oxidizing agents for electrons. Acid-base reactions involve competitions between bases for protons. Precipitation reactions involve competitions of anions and cations for each other, or for water molecules, and complexing reactions involve competitions of ligands for metal ions. In each type of reaction, we have been able to identify the competitors and the thing they are competing for, in the same way that we would in a football match or a game of cards. But the similarity goes even further than this, because chemists have found a way of representing the score, or what we might call a measure of competitiveness, in these reactions. We use electrode potentials in redox reactions, dissociation constants in acid-base reactions, solubility products in precipitation reactions, and stability constants in complexing reactions.